We're going to go ahead and get started. Members are at different meetings, and we don't have a quorum, but we do have some people who have checked in and have testimony today from our two agencies, that some of their jurisdiction, the Housing Finance Agency and the Minnesota Department of Health. So we're first going to start with the Housing Finance Agency, Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and I'd like to ask Tanya Orr to come forward. Welcome to the committee. I just wonder, if we invited the Commissioner Mark sometime, would he come?
Madam Chair, I'm sure he would be happy to come. It's a question of whether he would have, whether his schedule would permit it, whether he could rearrange his schedule.
Maybe we'll invite him. I think it would be nice for members to see the Commissioner someday. We like seeing you, of course, and you're very expert on all of these issues. It's just, I haven't seen him yet this year, so.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Tanya Orr from the Housing Finance Agency, and I'm just going to briefly review the Governor's Supplemental Budget proposals for the Housing Finance Agency. The Supplemental Budget proposal from the Governor in House File 3972, it was just introduced yesterday, and so I made a copy of the Housing Finance Agency provision, and I think those were distributed. You will see that there are no reductions recommended by the governor for the Housing Finance Agency. Part of the reason, and I'm not going to profess to have inside knowledge about all of the discussions about the budget, but as you know, the Housing Finance Agency does not receive an appropriation from the legislature for the operations of the agency. That money is generated from our bond sales. The money that's appropriated by the legislature to the agency goes 100% to programs. So I think that is one of the reasons that there were no reductions. Also, I think just given the current economic situation, this is probably the last time you would want to stop making investment in housing. We know that we have a housing crisis in terms of foreclosures right now. I know that there are lots of concerns about losing skilled labor in the housing industry because of construction. We can help in terms of both new construction and employing people in rehabilitation. So there are no budget cuts recommended in the governor's supplemental budget. There are three provisions in the bill relating to the Housing Finance Agency that are found in Article 2. Sections 6 and 7 are the nonprofit housing bond provisions that we talked about in the context of the capital bonding. They are part of Representative Benson's bill that you recommended be included in the capital investment bill, and in fact they are in that bill. So I'd like to draw your attention to Section 8, which is the one provision that you haven't seen yet. That is a provision that requests an increase in the agency's debt ceiling. The Housing Finance Agency has a limitation on how much debt it can issue that's established in statute. It has been changed periodically since the inception of the agency. Currently at $3 billion. One of the things I want to make clear about this is that the state has absolutely no legal obligation for the debt of the Housing Finance Agency. And the state and the agency's debt ceiling has no impact on the state's ability to borrow. We are in a situation that we had expected when the debt ceiling was last increased that it would be good through 2010. We have done record first-time homebuyer mortgage business in the last 3 years. And as a result, we are in danger of pushing against our debt ceiling in calendar year 2009. If we don't change the debt ceiling this year, it will mean that we would have to manage our mortgage revenue bond program and limit it so that we would not push up against the debt ceiling or achieve the debt ceiling next year. So that's why we're asking that this year it be increased. We're asking that it be increased to $5 billion. That we expect will take us for another 7 years. So that's about what we were at. Last time we asked for an increase was to take us out about 7 years, and that's what we're asking for again this time. Again, this is not an obligation of the state. It is solely an obligation of the Housing Finance Agency. I had distributed for you the most recent report from Standard and Poor's on the Housing Finance Agency. You will notice on page 2 of that report that Standard and Poor's has a positive outlook for which their way of saying that there is that we are positioned for an upgrade from AA plus to AAA. There is a discussion on page 7 of the debt of the agency. Overall, this is they're reaffirming our AA plus rating. We have spoken with both Moody's and Standard & Poor's about the need to increase the debt ceiling, and they are very supportive and have no concerns about that. I think the one provision in the budget bill that you haven't seen before that we think is really critical to the continued robust activity that the agency has seen over the last 2 years in terms of helping first-time homebuyers. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, question, Vanessa. I have a question looking at the handout here from the ratings standard report. It talks on page 2 about the adequacy position, capital adequacy position after the financial restructuring became effective July 2007. What financial restructuring of MHFA are they talking about?
Madam Chair, we have agency resources that are monies that are the difference between what we sell, the amount, what we sell bonds at and what we loan money at. There's a spread that we're allowed. That goes to fund the agency's operations. At times, it generates additional income. We had a very complicated structure about where that money went in terms of what accounts it went into and how that money moved around. We simplified that to a great extent last summer. The board reviewed this and approved the simplification so that now it's very clear where those agency resources are and how much they are. That is money that complements the state appropriations. It's the additional money that we use for deferred loans, just like much of the state appropriations, so that it's what allows us to serve lower income homeowners or home buyers with down payment assistance, supplements the down payment assistance program and the challenge program and the long term homeless effort. So that was the restructuring was really a simplification and a clarification of the flow of funds.
So can you tell me what is the dollar amount that we're talking about there that's simplified? What are we putting in that fund to simplify?
Madam Chair, we have this, the agency resources, I mean, there are lots of different funds, but the agency resources are in a fund that we call Pool 3 or the Foundation. And we have $50 million available over the a two-year period to make deferred loans.
And anybody else have questions? I wanted to look at the bill for just a second. Now, would you remind us again, and this is on the back side of the handout that you provided with us, but, on line 15.14 down to 15.17, could you tell me again what another account that the agency may transfer the proceeds of the nonprofit housing bonds. I believe when you talked with us about that before, it gives some flexibility for other kinds of usage, I think. Can you just remind me though for sure what that does do?
Yes, Madam Chair. Keep in mind that we're establishing this nonprofit housing bond process with the idea that this cycle we would use the money for a permanent supported housing for long-term homeless. But in other cycles, we will come back and we will ask for money to be used for other purposes. So that's why we have language that it gets moved from one account into another program. This year, our intention is that the money would be used in the Housing Trust Fund, which is a program that provides capital, operating subsidies, and rental assistance for rental housing for very low-income persons. In other years, it's possible that we might think about workforce housing, public housing preservation, or other rehabilitation, land trust, any number of things. And so that language would allow us to transfer the money into another existing program rather than to every 2 years have to establish a new program.
I'm sure you probably recall I did have a bill that would have asked that some of the housing bonds be used to be available for housing land trust. We talked about that in this committee in my bill. It could be something then, depending on, I mean, the agency could do it whenever they want to. They could switch into some of these other accounts. This gives you the flexibility, right?
Madam Chair, it does. It gives us the flexibility within the limits of lines 14.31 through 13.33 through 15.3. So that particular authorization sets the use of the money, the bond proceeds, this particular time. So in future years, we would expect that you will see different language with recommending different uses. So by giving us this authorization, you are establishing the uses, and then the language later in the paragraph allows us to move the money into an existing program so that we don't have to create a new program to get the money.
So if I understand the language that you referred to under the authorization, that is very limiting language then. It can only be used for long-term supportive housing. At this point, I don't see a place where it puts a time limit on that. And is your reading of that it's the $30 million and that's the limit, and so it's not a time limit, but it's a dollar amount limit?
Okay, that's correct.
Okay. Just another question. I don't know if other members have questions too, but in general, one of the issues there's two questions, I guess. The $2.4 million annually, has the governor included that in the budget somewhere for us? It says up to $2.4 is appropriated, and this is the place where he is putting that $2.4 million. Is that right on line?
Madam Chair, that's my understanding. Yes.
Okay, so that should be coming to this committee. All right. All right. Then I guess the other question I have is a more general question, which is in this time of incredible foreclosure challenges, I just was looking for a little more leadership, I guess, from the governor's office in terms of how we might go forward and try to deal with that foreclosure issues. And I think that the long-term homelessness is fine, but that's only going to, I don't know how much it's even going to impact the foreclosure. I think it will as time goes on, but it's because it's so limited and it's people who've been chronically homeless. A lot of our new homeless people who may be losing their homes because of foreclosures and so on. Was that discussed at all? I imagine it was discussed somewhat in your agency, and I know there was some, there were some dollars that were retrieved from the account and put forward to be used in one instance. But you know, this is going to be with us for a few years, and I'm just looking for that kind of leadership from the governor's office. I don't see it in the bill that he's proposing to us, and I'm wondering what you can tell us about. Any further discussions? Did the agency have ideas that the governor did not like, or what can we expect?
Madam Chair, we did submit a proposal for increased funding to address the foreclosure issue, to essentially replicate what we did in Minneapolis and St. Paul last spring. there obviously a lot of pressures on the budget. While it's not reflected in the supplemental budget, there are a number of things that we have done since last spring. As you mentioned, we negotiated with the Department of Commerce and had $500,000 transferred from the real estate education and research account to the agency for an early intervention outreach project to get to people before they got into foreclosure. We used some agency resources to fund additional foreclosure prevention counselors, doubling the number of counselors last winter. We, as I mentioned, when Representative Dabney filled it before you, we recently received an award from Marquette Bank of $500,000 to make additional financial assistance available to people who are facing foreclosure. We also recently awarded almost $5 million from the federal government for counseling efforts. This is through NeighborWorks. And we received the second highest award. Minnesota received the second highest award in this country. So we will be able to put a substantial number of additional counselors to work over the next year as a result of that funding. We have also been working with our congressional delegation to pursue, as originally we were hoping it would be part of the second economic stimulus package, to pursue an increase in the mortgage revenue bond tax. We think that this is one of the ways that we can, that housing finance agencies can help with the foreclosure problem. If we had an increase in the tax, we would be able to issue more mortgage revenue bonds, tax exempt bonds, and make money available for to more home buyers at a favorable rate. And, you know, as I've said in the past, despite the fact that we're seeing large numbers of foreclosures, the agency's delinquency and foreclosure rate, while it's increased slightly, is still well below what the private sector is experiencing. And I think that's for several reasons. We have favorable rates. We work really hard with our servicer to make sure that they work, you know, work out arrangements with homeowners instead of foreclosing. And we do counseling for many of the providers. So if we had an increase in the mortgage revenue bond tax, we could help more people in that way. One of the proposals is that not only would there be an increase in the tax, but also we would be allowed to serve non-first-time homebuyers. At this point, we have the authority to do refinancing, but we don't have a ready source of money to do refinancing. Issuing taxable bonds is really not an option. It doesn't, you know, we can't compete with the private sector. If we could issue not tax-exempt bonds, we may be able to issue to provide a more favorable rate. It has some limitations because, as we've discussed in other contexts, some people are in a situation where their assessed values now are less than their loan amount, and so those are difficult situations to refinance. But we do think that the federal government could help us a lot in providing us with some additional tools to help with the foreclosure, and we have been working very hard with our congressional delegation to get them to pursue that agenda.
And just the last comment you made, is the tax exempt bond proposal part of what you're asking them to do, or that is not part of what you're asking?
Yes, that is what we're asking.
So is that, you know, I'm wondering if you have maybe a document that could tell us the ideas that you have asked the federal government to work with you, and it would be helpful. The committee here might be able to be supportive or not, and you know, be useful for us.
I'd be happy to get you something.
Right. Any other questions, comments? Oh, yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to have you make sure my thinking is correct.
Uh-huh.
In the bill,
yes.
We talked and we set up a definition of nonprofit housing bonds,
mm-hmm.
establishing that as a subsection. And then you're talking about $2.4 million being annually appropriated for debt service. And then we're going to subdivision 4, which is the authorization of the $30 million. So those are all tied.
Mm-hmm.
But that $30 million is restricted to permanent supportive housing. And then you give a definition of that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm through that part.
Okay.
But then when I get down to the question that the chairman asked on subdivision 32, nonprofit housing bonds account, and the last sentence, the agency may transfer the proceeds of nonprofit housing bonds to another account within the housing development fund that it determines appropriate to accomplish the purpose which the bonds are authorized.
Mm-hmm.
Now that looks like a total slip. I mean, that's a bad word. That looks like your ability then at some time to take whatever is in the nonprofit housing bonds fund that has a debt service established and has a $30 million for supportive housing, and then subdivision 32 says, however, we can reappropriate that any way we want to accomplish the purpose of the bond. Or is that restricted to permanent supportive housing?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, it is restricted because the language says to accomplish the purpose for which the bonds are authorized. And in subdivision 4 of the previous section, you authorize these bonds for permanent supportive housing. And that is, if we were 2 years from now, if we wanted to have ask you for debt service on another set of bonds, we would have to ask for authorization and for a purpose. So this is, and then there's the practical matter. Here's how I think about it. We're establishing a pot to put the bond proceeds in. That's just a pot to hold the money. We need to have some rules and a program on how we spend the money. And so subdivision 32 says we can move it into the program pot. And in this case, it will be the housing trust fund. And we thought that was a very practical way to deal with this because, as I said, 2 years from now, we will be back asking for another set of authorization. It won't be exclusively for permanent supportive housing. So we can't establish a program. We need to be able to move it into another program that accomplishes the purposes that you've authorized the bond for.
Okay, Madam Chair. So you're creating here is a vehicle, but the supportive housing that we're articulating now stays as supportive housing.
Madam Chair,
Representative
Peterson, that's right.
Okay.
Representative Peterson, before we go to you, Representative Trump, I just wanted to ask a question. In the House bonding bill, we had another $2 million, I believe, in the bonding bill that was proposed for another use, which is dealing with publicly owned transitional shelter and other kinds of housing. So unless that is added to this language here, I mean, the governor is not supporting that, I guess, at this point. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Representative
Shepard. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Commissioner Orr may have clarified my question already, but I just wanted to ask, if I have an adjustable rate mortgage for a couple hundred thousand dollars and it's going to adjust up and I can't handle it, you're saying that you're talking to the federal government about trying to get some additional money so that you could refinance my loan. Correct.
Madam Chair, Representative Sumner, we're asking, we're constrained by tax law, essentially. That sets a cap on the amount of tax-exempt bonds for private activities that any state can get. And in the case of housing, we can only issue bonds for first-time home buyers and for certain kinds of rental housing. So we can't do any refinancing with the tax exempt bond story. So we are asking the congressional delegation to support, as part of an economic stimulus or a bond, a tax credit modernization act, to support an increase, even if it's a one-time increase, it would be helpful, for an increase in that tax and allow us to use some portion of that for refinancing.
Yeah. It seems to me, Madam Chair, it seems to me that that's really what's needed here. I mean, for a lot of these people, there's no other way out unless they can refinance at a lower interest rate so they can have some payments that they can handle. And, you know, it just seems, and these are not first-time homeowners, obviously. So that's good. I really appreciate that you're doing that.
Other questions from committee members? Okay. Is there anybody in the audience who wants to testify to this particular issue? Okay. Then I guess we're going to move on. Thank you, Mr. Next we hear from the Department of Health. Governor's budget recommendations. I'm ready to Mr. Apel. That's it?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. And Ms. Kelly, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Margaret Kelly. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Health. And I want to extend to you all greetings from our commissioner, who would have liked to have been here today, wasn't able to accommodate it in her schedule. We are going to present for you the governor's supplemental budget recommendations that pertain to the Department of Health, and in particular to the part of our budget over which your committee has jurisdiction. And Craig Akim, our Chief Financial Officer, is going to walk you through those recommendations.
Madam Chair, good morning, committee members. I would like to start by calling...
Introduce yourself to the table.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Craig Akim. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Minnesota Department of Health. And as Assistant Commissioner Kelly said, I'd like to walk you through the change items to our budget that are part of the governor's supplemental budget. I'd like to first call your attention to a page in your packet entitled Agency Operations Reductions. And the governor is recommending a reduction in the Department of Health general fund base budget of $2.5 million per year, $2.52 million per year in 2009 and $2.47 million per year thereafter. By way of introduction to this, as a result of the November forecast, in January, all state agencies were asked to look for reductions in their budget in both their grant programs and their administrative operations. And I don't think that, other than the fact that it's our fiscal responsibility to balance the budget, and it appeared that there was a deficit in this biennium, that we would have offered any of these reductions here today other than for that fact. And the programs that are outlined for reduction, the fact that they're on this list, I don't think is any indication of their value or their effectiveness. It's really a matter of the agency looking at our budget and attempting to make difficult decisions in the most responsible way we could. And I would say that the grant programs here in particular, maybe a defining characteristic of all of them, is that in general something happened where they received increased funding or new funding in the last legislative session, where it appeared in this biennium that we would have additional money to increase our investment in these programs. And now in light of the current economic forecast, it appears that we will not have the money available in this biennium to make those investments. And so we're proposing to reduce back those new investments to their original level. And so I'd like to just quickly walk you through them. The first is a reduction to our fetal alcohol syndrome grant program in the amount of $500,000. This is a grant used specifically targeted to the Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, MOFAS, which uses the money to do a variety of prevention and intervention work on fetal alcohol spectrum disorders across the state. As you may recall, the governor proposed increasing funding for this grant program by $900,000 last session, and the legislature approved a $500,000 increase. But now, in light of the current reality of this biennial budget, we're proposing that $500,000 be reduced and bring the grant program back to its original funding level of $1.2 million. The second reduction is in our tobacco-free community grants program. This is another grant program which has been in existence since approximately 1999. It's about $2.5 million, which goes out entirely in grants to organizations across the state to help us reduce the impact of youth and smoking While this program did not specifically receive an increase in funding last session, we do feel that because of ongoing efforts since 1999, and also in addition to the passage of the Freedom to Breathe Act last session, that this is a place where if we need to make a reduction, we think we could do that, given the progress we've made towards the goal of reducing youth and tobacco influences. The third grant program on the list falls up before the province of Representative Huntley's committee, and we did present this information to that committee yesterday, and Representative Huntley, though not here today, did hear about this reduction. Basically, it's a new program that was going to be in northeastern Minnesota, a five-year demonstration grant to offer individuals the option of purchasing health care coverage in a different way. And the governor and us are proposing that before that program really gets underway, which it has not, that we would not make that investment at this time. And then the final grant program on the list is a reduction to the ClearCore Lead Grant program. Madam Chair, I'm aware of your support for this program. And this is another situation where though it's a valuable program, the money goes to an AmeriCorps program here in Minnesota that does lead risk assessments and lead hazard reduction services for homeowners. This was a case where we increased the investment last session in this program, and in light of the current budget, don't feel that that's a sustainable choice to make at this time, and would restore it back to the original funding level. And then the final reduction that we're putting forward in the governor's budget is a $1.1 million reduction on the back page to our agency's administrative operations. And this represents a 4% reduction, which most executive branch agencies were asked to take. And in light of this, the size of this reduction is based primarily on the February forecast, which we just became aware of the full amount recently. And so we haven't had time to determine exactly how we would make this reduction within our agency. And then the second part of our change items I'd like to call your attention to is the second sheet, which at the top says State Government Special Revenue Appropriations. And these are actually proposals to increase. The governor is recommending an appropriation increase from our State Government Special Revenue Fund, which is the fund we use to collect fees for the various regulatory and licensing and inspection activities that the Department of Health carries out across the state. In particular, there's two places where we're looking to increase the appropriation. One is for funding food, beverage, and lodging inspections in St. Louis County, and the second is for increased licensure and inspection of public swimming pools that are not associated with food or lodging establishments. In terms of the first one, the St. Louis County inspection proposal, St. Louis County has long inspected their food, beverage, and lodging establishments themselves under a delegation agreement through the Department of Health. In recent months, the St. Louis County Board has informed us by resolution that they no longer wish to carry out that activity, and so therefore the responsibility and authority reverts back to the Department of Health. This would in essence be a transfer of fees that are currently collected for those purposes from St. Louis County to the Department of Health, and then an appropriate or a proportional appropriation increase for the Department of Health to then fund those activities in St. Louis County. And then the second proposal was the swimming pool regulation modification. This is in response to the tragic accident, I'm sure many of you remember, involving Abigail Taylor, a young girl who was injured in a swimming pool here in the Twin Cities last year. And the governor and the department both support measures to increase the licensing and inspection of all public swimming pools to ensure that they are safe for all citizens of Minnesota. And this would actually expand the current licensing inspection from pools that are associated with food, beverage, and lodging associations or businesses to all public pools. And the fees from this would come from licensing fees that we currently charge those establishments, but now these additional pool owners would pay. And then the cost of the new appropriation would be to manage that program. And this is currently being carried in a bill by Representative Houston, I believe, which the governor supports. And so with that, that's my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you. You have a great man to come before us today. I probably have a lot of questions for you. Was the swimming pool accident, was that in St. Louis Park, did you say?
I did not say, but I believe it was.
Well, by coincidence, I think, we have ninth grade students who are visiting us here from St. Louis Park High School, and we want to walk near their part of the voice of the people, and if you just stand up and be recognized, I want to thank you for joining us today. So we may be covering an issue that you all know something about that happened to the little girl in the swimming pool, huh? You all know about that? Yeah, okay. All right, who had the first question here? Representative Swales.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am very concerned about the cut that you have for the fetal alcohol syndrome program. That is, in my estimation, one of the most preventable problems in terms of health that we have. And I do know that the numbers of people, particularly in some of our tribal communities, they experience disproportionate amounts of fetal alcohol syndrome. And as a public school teacher, I can tell you that it is a tragedy that does not need to happen to our children. We pay for it on the other end. We pay for it in education. The escalating costs in special education are sometimes fueled by this very syndrome. So I just bristle when I see something like that. It is such a positive program being on the board to be cut. And I don't know if it's, you know, I just don't want to think that the reason this one was slated is because of lack of care for those communities. But education and providing prenatal health that is so vital to our babies and to the mothers who are carrying them is paramount to creating a healthy population. So that is just my two cents worth, but I am very distressed when I see that.
Madam Chair, Representative Swales, we don't disagree with you. Fetal alcohol syndrome is a serious problem, and doing work on fetal alcohol spectrum disorders is important work. And we've had a long partnership with MOFAS. You know, these are difficult budget times, and we have difficult decisions to make. And I think that the thought was that the governor proposed increasing the funding for this last year, and we supported that, and so did the legislature. But we probably made that increase in funding at a time when now it appears that we didn't. And that's really the thinking behind this reduction, is taking back the increase that appeared to be available in the last budget projection, but now in the current biennium vision. But rest assured, though, that the program will continue, and it's they're a valuable partner and an important part of the work we do at the Department of Health.
I just want to ask a question, and maybe you can add this to each of the questions that others would ask. I think the question about the cost-benefit analysis, what happens, in terms of supposedly we're saving money on the front end. Has the department, since you were the ones who recommended to the governor each of these programs, because if I understood you correctly, these are your recommendations, so the people before us made these recommendations to the governor. Did you do a cost-benefit analysis on any of these proposed reductions, four reduction initiatives? In other words, the cost of the special education, the cost of damaged children, in this one particular instance, dealing with fetal alcohol, did you do a cost-benefit analysis for us that we can know how much it's going to cost us down the line not to do this investment? Yeah,
Madam Chair, no, we didn't do that as specifically as part of this exercise. So,
Is that something you could do? If we sent you away with an assignment today to say, we would like to know, by not, you know, helping X number of children, like I would be interested if you could quantify how many fetal alcohol births we will have now as a result of this loss of funding. And then if we could add, if we could, with each one of those children, figure out what the cost would be long term to their life. Like I know when we get down to the childhood lead poisoning, that's been done. And we can talk about that. But up here for fetal alcohol, I don't know if it's been done. It's probably been done by the organization that's funded, who you said will continue on. I guess I don't know if there's anybody here from that organization, but when we get time for public testimony, I think it would be helpful to know if someone's been doing that kind of work, because otherwise, you know, we're kind of in the dark.
And, Madam Chair, I think I understand your question and appreciate your concern. But maybe to reframe this in another way, the work that MOFAS has been doing around fetal alcohol syndrome has been going on for a number of years and will continue to go on. In essence, 8 months ago, they received an increase in funding of $500,000. And I don't know that enough time or has passed for them to even be able to speak to any significant change or improvement in the status of what you're describing. And so I'm not sure how we would quantify it. It isn't to say that investment here isn't needed. It's just to say that it doesn't appear that we have the financial resources to make that investment right now in light of the current budget situation.
I guess just one thing I would say is any of these, each of these areas, the people who came to us said there's an unmet need. We're not asking for money that we don't need. So there were numbers that were given. And after you maybe do a little homework, go back and find out what those numbers were and then put a figure to what the cost is, if you would, please. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, ma'am. I've got a couple of questions. Let me start with the second one. I'm looking at the Special Revenue Appropriation St. Louis County, which is Duluth. And what it tells me is the county is deciding they are no longer going to be responsible for inspecting all the food and beverage in that county of 1,000 facilities. And they're going to turn it over to the state. You will pick up about $468,000 a year that you charge to the restaurants and the hotels that you inspect. And it always amazes me that the counties would do that. In my community, we have 7,500 hotel rooms, and I don't know how many seats we have in restaurants, and we do that ourselves because we say that the most important thing from a tourist and visitation standpoint is that people are assured when they come to 494, their food is hot, the salads are cold, the kitchens are clean, and the city will break the arm of the operator if they don't do that. And that's an assurance thing. And yet, it just amazes me that as much money and effort that Duluth puts into tourism and its deck and everything else, that they're abdicating that responsibility. Now, I'm sure you can't comment on it, but it just amazes me that they would do that. And so now you're forced to add how many full-time equivalents to start doing it for them. And that's just a comment. It just amazes me that Duluth would walk away from that, given the importance of tourism to their community and the fact that we're going to invest millions of dollars into their convention center and their sheets of ice, and they don't even assure their guests in that community that the food inspection is being done appropriately. That's amazing. I'll leave that alone. Secondly, you tell me on agency operations, I'm going back to your baseline budget reduction of 15 full-time employees, 3.4% permanent reduction, and then you think you made the comment you haven't quite figured out yet who, what, and how you're going to do that. What does that mean? I mean, somehow, because of all the things that you do, those 15 employees and that budget is going to be seen somewhere. Where are we going to see it? What are we going to see happening because of this?
Ma'am.
Maybe you don't want to tell us, but tell us.
I'm happy to say what Madam Chair, Representative Peterson. The governor, in the last week or so, asked in light of the size of the budget deficit for all state agencies to reduce their agency operations by 4%. And these dollar amounts represent what that means to us. In terms of how to make those cuts, I think we want to be thoughtful. We would certainly try to do them in a way that would continue our high quality of operations and the depth of our programs. But we need some time to think about that and examine it and look at it. And so this language that's here about reductions, restructuring, possibly eliminating some services, you know, those are all possibilities. But the reality is that it would probably take us until later in the session before we really have a plan exactly how we're going to manage that. The February forecast deficit number was much larger than the number in November, and frankly, while this will be difficult, I think it's important for us to do our piece to manage those cost reductions.
Madam Chair, I know the boss has said you have to do it, but it's coming out of the back of public health. I mean, you're the gatekeeper. Your department is our assurance. You're the sheriff of public health, like you will be in the restaurants in Duluth. And it's going to be tough, isn't it?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, I think that reductions are always a challenge. But I think we're committed to being responsible in our fiscal service.
Maybe just a comment from your comments. Since you will be making that decision, and at least sometime during the session, I'd like to ask that you let us know, as you have, you know, when the first notices go out, I mean, we might hear anyway, but it would be nice to have it come from you folks. If you would mind, we'd like to know, you know, which departments, which individuals are being laid off. 15, do you think it'll be 15 people?
Madam Chair, that's just an estimate based on the size of the cut.
Okay.
A large portion of our internal agency operations budget is staff salaries. And so it's hard to say what the actual number would be. Provided I'm not one of the people laid off, I'd be happy to come back and report this.
Well, we sure hope that you're not. But is it likely that those layoffs would be related to the budget cuts that you've presented here today?
Madam Chair, you mean in terms of the grants?
Mm-hmm. Well, the four programs that are cut, that the governor recommends to cut, is it likely that those would be the areas where you would be laying off people or not?
Madam Chair, no, I wouldn't say that's necessarily the case.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We all knew this period in the budget process was going to be facing us, and so we have two presenters here who are presenting these proposals, one of whom is a constituent of mine, so we want to make sure we keep this on the issues and not on personalities, not blame the messengers, I guess, is what I'm saying. But just a couple of questions, again, about the St. Louis County Inspection Program. So what is being suggested is then that state fees be raised to supplant the fees, I assume, that St. Louis County was charging or levying. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Benson and Representative Benson and I are neighbors.
And in that regard, I'll be working very hard to get all the funds that you would like.
I think it's fair to say this committee has strongly supported this department. We want you to have the dollars that you need. We're not happy about these cuts because we want you to be doing the public health work. And we're quite hopeful with the new commissioner, I think, that might be a change. And I guess we're still learning about that.
Well, we appreciate that support, Madam Chair.
So my question is, so the governor is proposing that the state raise fees. Is that correct, again?
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, the fees are already being collected. Every food, beverage, and lodging establishment in St. Louis County pays a fee.
But to the county, correct?
But to the county, those would now be transferred to the state.
And are those fees that the state is proposing adequate to cover the expenses, the inspections that the county is carrying on?
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, they're very close. If you look at the sheets, the entitled State Government Special Revenue Appropriations, the St. Louis County portion, in essence, the fees are $468,000 a year that are coming in, and we expect our cost for the state to do these inspections to actually be $435,000 in the next year, but then they do rise to $524,000 in fiscal years 10 and 11. So they, over the course of, when we set fees, we establish them over a period of time. They don't necessarily balance on a year-to-year basis. And so we think that it will balance out over the period of time that we look at.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we're talking here then of basically a wash. It's just a transfer from the county to the state. Does that impact, Madam Chair, does that impact in any way on these proposed cuts that you're making here?
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, no, they really don't. So.
Okay. Well, last thing, Madam Chair, I'd like to support your comments about long-term costs of these cuts to our economy. And I know many of us, you know, whether we're governors or members of the legislature, don't plan to spend the next 30 years here. And I'm just concerned that this governor or this legislature will be passing excessive costs onto future legislatures in order to take care of a short-term problem we have now. We on this committee did not propose these investments just because we thought it would be fun. We were looking at these as ways of saving the state a lot of money in the future. And I think the governor and the legislature should be willing to acknowledge the fact that by making these cuts, the state will be incurring long-term expenses which we could have avoided if there had been more careful consideration of the state budget in the first place. And over the last few years, it seems that politics many times run these decisions to the detriment of the health of the state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Benson. Next, Representative Moe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Akam, this is going to kind of echo what some other committee members have said to you, and I know where your heart is, and this is difficult for you to do, bringing messages forward. However, as you know, our committee's responsibility is to make sure that we're protecting the public health and getting you the resources to do that. And as you know from our area where you used to live, that fetal alcohol syndrome is a huge problem. I mean, this the issues that those children bring into the school district cost us literally millions of dollars up north to try to address. And I think cutting this particular grant program, and as you said, however, it is an increase, but it's a drop in the bucket compared to the magnitude of the problem that we face and the corresponding challenges that we then have dealing with the families and these children after the fact. Since the governor has continued to express his desire or willingness to raise fees, I would think that there's got to be a way that we can continue to fund this through user fees. I mean, the department is taking on additional pool inspections because one child has experienced serious health challenges. And don't get me wrong, we feel strongly that we should do something about that. However, we're talking about thousands of children. There's got to be a way that we can get the revenue necessary to fund this problem, and I know that you understand it more so than I do, and I know that your job doesn't allow you to advocate for a particular fee increase to pay for it, though maybe you can give us some hints as to where we might go about coming up with this money.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Moe, I well, thank you for your support of our programs. And we do consider that the work around fetal alcohol syndrome is very important. And we want that to continue. I think, though, that the real challenge for the Department of Health, and I think that no one is more committed to protecting and improving the health and lives of people in Minnesota, as part of our mission as a department, that all of the work we do is also equally as important. And the reality is that we, as stewards of the government of Minnesota, need to be thoughtful in how we make choices in times of limited funds. And these are challenging times for all of us, with a $935 million deficit facing us in the next year and a half, less than a year and a half. I think that last session, the department came forward and said, we do want to make an increased investment in this because we do recognize the value of, or the scope of the problem. On the other hand, I don't know that it would be wise or valuable to take away any of the other things that we are also trying to do that are also equally important to maintain the level of commitment we've made here in a time when maybe we were premature in offering that increased investment. It's probably not a great answer. And I don't know that I can offer you any more insight on how we can come up with funding for FAS. But I think that, you know, our goal here really has been to try to be as responsible as we can with the budget situation so far.
Madam Chair, Mr. Akam, I know you're in a tough spot. I think our committee will come up with a strategy for this. I'm assuming this is important to all or most of the committee members. I just want to leave you with an additional thought. I mean, we were in Environment Policy Committee last night, and we were talking about a bill on environmental racism and social justice. And if we look at the budget for the Minnesota Department of Health, there are some priorities in the Department of Health that are real, that are needed, but that are driven by public sentiment around issues in the metro area because of the access to media, the access to wealthy neighborhoods. This is a particular issue of social justice, where there are communities in the north that don't have the wherewithal to advocate for themselves as much as communities down here, which are further from the mainstream media, and therefore, I would argue, get a disproportionately lower share of concern from all state agencies, not just yours. And so by us backpedaling on this particular program, we're exacerbating that difference. And I, for one, think that's a problem, and I will respectfully disagree with your position on this, and hopefully we can come up with a better alternative for you to carry forward.
I just know just the bill we should do, huh? I said we might just have an idea about what that bill should be. Representative Shumpert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think everyone would agree I'm not nearly as diplomatic as Representative Benson and Representative Moe. I frankly am angry about the short-sightedness of the governor in making these proposed cuts, and especially as they relate to the youth tobacco prevention grants. I want to show you what we're up against here. The tobacco companies now in the cities are now having one-night Vegas parties at local entertainment places for young women, okay? And you can get your hair done and do all kinds of things. And I had to keep Representative Medora from sticking these in her pocket, but they give out designer lighters, and they give out, I'll pass these around, but don't stick them in your purse there. They give out nice, fancy cigarette cases, and I don't know. Yeah, well, you can have those too, but, you know, this is the kind of stuff we're up against here now with tobacco, and you can, this is the camel designer cotton, I guess, or whatever it is.
With coupons.
With coupons, okay. And they got to go back right in the door. I know you steal those, but, you know, this is the kind of thing we're up against here with trying to prevent the young people from smoking. And I can't think of anything that's going to improve public health faster and more directly than keeping people from smoking. Can you talk to us a little bit about what this, how much we're spending on smoking cessation in the state? Do you have that number?
Madam Chair, I don't have that number.
Well, I happen to have a sheet here, and it says about we're spending about $3.25 million on total on tobacco cessation in the state. That's about 65 cents per person. And so the governor is proposing we cut 10% of that. I mean, you know, and then we have to compete with Camel and having these kind of parties now. Representative Medora was a little younger. She's probably going to those, I guess. But, you know, I just think this is outrageous, and it just undercuts everything we've tried to do with the Freedom to Breathe Act and all of the other efforts we've put at trying to reduce smoking in the last several years in this state. And so I really am angry about that. It seems to me that for pennies, we could be raising additional revenue in this state from people who can afford to pay a little more in taxes, and we wouldn't have to be sending kids off, young women and their 19 and 20 year olds, off to a life of smoking and breast cancer and whatever else, you know. Yeah. And so I'm really angry about it.
Thank you. Mr. Medora.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Summers. I would like to actually go to one of those parties and ask them, what are they doing at this age to be involved in that? But can't fight camel today. But I do have some grave concerns about these cuts here. And what concerns me the most is that almost every single one of these programs affect children.
Mm-hmm.
And that's disgraceful. I have great concern about the FAS grant reductions. We heard very compelling testimony here last year about how important these programs were, the need for us to address through education programs in the north, in the south, any of our poorer communities. This is a number one issue for them in trying to reduce, as Representative Swale, she put it perfectly, this is a birth defect that is solely and 100% preventable with education. And for us to be saying that these children and these families and these children are not worth $500,000 a year, one child that's diagnosed with this disability will cost us $500,000. One. So we're prepared here to say that we're not willing to invest more money in it. The tobacco-free communities, I know in Dakota County, we have been struggling to try to keep the message out there about youth smoking and to stop that behavior through education programs, having things available in the schools. When a 19-year-old or an 18-year-old can go out and get the same information off the Internet, sign up, get mailings directly there, I'm not understanding the philosophy here. And again, I know that this may not be something that you personally advocated for, but I think that we need to have a little more thoughtfulness. I'm also very concerned about the community-based healthcare demonstration grant. We specifically put that in order for us to look at reducing healthcare costs in the state. This governor has made an agenda item for him. He's gone out on a limb over and over again. Smoking, obesity, these are the problems that are affecting us. Yet you have a tobacco-free grant here that you're looking to cut, and then a new way for us to purchase health care. What better way for us to be spending dollars in public health than to analyze whether or not there's a better way for us to be doing this? The Clear Course, again, we had compelling testimony. That puts people, not only does it save children, it puts people back in their homes. I'm not understanding why that's even up for discussion. This program, it has value. It's the only program that's offered in the state that does it as well that needs to be done to put these kids back in their homes. Again, one child is $388,000. And then we're turning around and you're saying agency operations and you're not sure how you're going to cut 15 people, I don't understand this governor's position. And I am sorry that you're being put in the position here of justifying it. I'm angry and I'm frustrated, and I see women and children, again, being the victims with very little advocation on the department's part to come back and say, you know what, this is the one group we're not going to touch again. There are other programs, there are other grant programs out there that the department supports, including, you know, I've been very vocal about the Positive Alternatives Grant. That's a multi-million dollar program that basically duplicates programs that are running in every single county in the state. And you're telling me you can't cut $2 million from that and save these programs for women and children? I don't see it. And I don't think the voters are going to see it either. So that's my position. It's more of a comment than I guess a direct question. But thank you for coming here today and having to endure our wrath, because I think we're all very, very frustrated at where we're ending up here. Thank you.
Representative McFarland, Swills, and then we have a number of witnesses who actually came to talk with us about these cuts today, so I just want to let members know that we do want to try to get to them if we can as well.
Madam Chair, I'm changing gears here back to the St. Louis County subject. Years in the 70s, my husband worked for the State Health Department, and we were in Duluth at that time, and they had a department that not only did hospitals and nursing homes, but also food service and things like that. Is that department still up there? Do they have an office there?
Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative McFarland, I'm not certain how they're structured in St. Louis County. I don't know if the Commissioner Kelly has.
I mean, it was a while ago.
No, Representative McFarland, the health department has a district office in Duluth, and it is an office where MDH employees who will do this inspection will be housed, and we also have folks housed in that office who do environmental health-related activities and who do, I believe, nursing home survey activities.
Okay. And Madam Chair, my other question is, how common is it for the state to take over this responsibility in other parts of the state?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative McFarland, I think that a trend has been in recent years to work more closely with counties, and where counties have the willingness and the capacity to take on those roles locally, we've been encouraging of that. And the department does have delegation authority that allows us to transfer our statutory responsibilities in certain cases to local jurisdictions to do that. St. Louis County, this is a case where they have been doing that for some time, and I really can't speak as to why they chose to stop doing it at this time.
This is Bill. Thank you, Madam Chair. And to echo my wonderful colleagues at, on the other side of the table, particularly Representative Moe, when I think about social justice issues, and the way we treat the more vulnerable people in our state, you know, I sit here and I feel a lot of guilt in some ways because I live in a very prosperous community. I'm in South Washington County, and we have made tremendous noise in South Washington County because of the water quality issues with the PFCs that have been in our aquifers and now have been detected in the water. And we've made a lot of noise, and we've gotten a lot of attention. We've been able to receive millions of dollars for remediation of that problem. I think the public health department has a responsibility to help keep our drinking water safe, and I am very, very grateful for that. I am so grateful for the attentiveness and the thoroughness and the testing and all of the work that has been done on our behalf by the Department of Health. But there's a little guilt in there for me as well, because we have made noise and we have been attended to. Then I look at these programs that affect our most vulnerable citizens in the state, and even though $500,000 is just a fraction of some of the money that's being spent on water quality issues, that $500,000 could save millions of dollars in the future. And so I need to echo that, what my colleagues have said. And when I look at
I have kind of a love-hate relationship, I think, with the Department of Health, and I mean that in a kind way, if they can be kind. But when I think about what happened to the miners up north with the asbestos fibers and the cancer that has been caused there, and the fact that the Department of Health sat on that information for a year and did not give that information to those miners about what was going on with their health, I think that that is unforgivable. And when I look at this kind of reaction, I get very frustrated. This is what I would like to say. I know that a great deal of money is coming into the Department of Health from 3M in relationship to the water quality issues. I want to make sure that that money is being spent well, that it is going towards public health issues, and that if you are finding money in excess of what is needed for South Washington County, if you find ways to use that money in the budget to help offset some of these crises, because 3M is paying a great deal of money to the Department of Health for the work that is being done in South Washington County. Some of it, to me, feels a little bit frivolous when I look at what's being cut here. So I'm not asking you questions. I'm simply commenting. There are parts of the Department of Health that I have such deep and profound respect for. But there are other parts that are a little suspect. And this is, for me, just unforgivable. These are our most vulnerable citizens. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Evelyn. Well, you know, we have people who've come today who want to speak to fetal alcohol syndrome, lead, smoking, and I'm not sure one we don't know. So I'd just actually like to ask you all to come down, the ones that are there, because I really do want to hear those numbers, and I want you to be able to take home some information maybe from those folks too as well. So let me just call down Jennifer Stevens first, Sam Walter, Jean Waitum, Stuart Hampton, and Sandra Sandell. If you can just kind of take your place down here, we want to try to give you time to talk to us, so we'll get you on board here and try to make sure we can get you. First was Jennifer and then Sam. Maybe you two could both come to the table. You have different topics, but we can... Jennifer? Just go ahead and take a seat right there. I just want you to be visible to the committee so we know we don't miss anybody.
I don't see it, Jennifer.
Okay. Okay, well, Sam, why don't you go first, then? You're next on the list.
Okay. Madam Chair, Member Sam Walsh, I represent the Sustainable Resources Center, and Representative Medora, I can't follow your act. That was wonderful. I'm here representing the lead grant program that is slated to be eliminated in fiscal 09 by the government's budget, and we think that is very unfortunate. Madam Chair, members, I'm going to try and be brief. I know you're running out of time and have some people you want to get through today, but with the appropriation you allotted last year, we've been able to draw down a dollar-for-dollar federal match for AmeriCorps program dollars that have gone into lead activities, lead poisoning prevention activities across the state. And activities are namely blood lead screening in children under the age of 6, in-home education to families, lead hazard control through cleaning, paint stabilization, and window replacement. In 2007, the Sustainable Resources Center was able to do 102 screening and education events in 14 counties across Minnesota. They conducted 195 in-home visits with families. They did 143 lead-specific cleanings at home. 1,483 lead-contaminated windows were replaced in 106 homes. 47 contractors were trained in lead-safe work practices. 140 landlords and homeowners were worked with to address lead hazards in their properties. We're taking a small amount of dollars and stretching as far as we can go. And Madam Chair, there's another key point that I want to bring up too. We were able to use these lead dollars with Hennepin County to apply for a HUD grant to draw down HUD funding. So we again were able to use those small appropriations you provided to leverage even more federal dollars. Hennepin County is drawing down $1.42 million to do lead hazard control work in Hennepin County, and we're using that FY09 appropriation as our local match. And I don't want to have to sit there and tell HUD that, well, thanks for the money you just gave us. By the way, we're backing out on our state commitments with our local match. Madam Chair, members, not only will we fail in our program objectives and goals, when we go to reapply for HUD dollars next time around, they're going to really frown upon Minnesota if we walked away from our local match and failed in our goals in this current grant cycle. Madam Chair, members, you also need to know lead poisoning is not just a problem in the urban core, although that is where the vast majority of the problem is. In 2006, there were 76 counties in Minnesota that had at least one child diagnosed with lead poisoning. It's extensive. The money, and here's the key point, for especially for greater Minnesota members, the money that the state is providing is the only money available to do education, outreach, and screening in greater Minnesota. If you eliminate that grant, we can't go get outside the Twin Cities and get out there. So you need to be aware of that. That's the only, those are the only funds available. Now, Chair, I could go on and on, but I just want to wrap up a couple of things. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention has determined that there's no evidence of a blood lead threshold below which adverse effects are not experienced. Exposure to lead by children under the age of 6 affects neurological development, including lowered intelligence, shortened attention span, decreased coordination, aggressive behavior, and learning disorders. Lead poisoning continues to be a problem for all of Minnesota and contributes to unnecessary health care, educational, and social costs. These costs are estimated at $1.2 billion per year in Minnesota, according to the Price of Pollution report that was issued by the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy and the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. There's also even recent, although very preliminary information and research that suggests lead poisoning and lead exposure is linked to Alzheimer's disease. And I think that's something we're growing more and more aware of and concerned about as we're trying to control long-term health care costs. Madam Chair, members, we need to hang on to that 09 appropriation. We've got too much on the line in terms of federal dollars we're trying to draw down that we've already committed ourselves to, and programs and prevention programs especially that we need to continue here in Minnesota. Madam Chair, with that, I'll close my comments and be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Wilson. I just want to emphasize one thing you said, which I think is not what the department said when they were describing these programs are all new money. This program this funding was a continuation, I believe, to replace a one-year funding that was there before, so we just continued the program on, if I'm not mistaken. And as you said, this will eliminate the program. This isn't just a cut. Is that right?
There's $100,000 per year in the base that has always sort of been here as long as I've been representing this program for 7 years now. And every budget cycle we have to come in, $100,000 doesn't get us very far. And so every budget year we come in and get an increase, and it's been a very big struggle because our state budget has been so problematic. So we come in and get an increase for 2 years, and then we have to come in and fight for it every 2 years. And so the money that the governor is recommending eliminating is $388,000, which is the money that was appropriated above the $100,000 base amount for the program in 2009.
I guess, Ms. Wilson, the thing I'm trying to say is the year before, I mean, this is not brand new money that you've not had before.
Madam Chair, that's correct. In the current fiscal year we're in the first year of the biennium that we're in right now, the program received $488,000.
I think that's important to committee members to know because it's not exactly a brand new appropriation that we did. We were trying to continue a program that was tried and true, and I just wanted to make sure we knew that.
Madam Chair, members, we just got all of our AmeriCorps people hired and trained, and they're out there working, and then to sit here and think about how we're going to have to lay everybody off and then not do any of the outreach and education programs in greater Minnesota, and then what we're going to tell HUD next year. It's a very frustrating position to be in once we just got this up and running.
Thank you. And I would ask you to share this information more specifically with Mr. Acom, because I'm giving him the assignment and the Assistant Commissioner as well of coming back and asking, giving us a cost-benefit analysis. So here's one source, and I hope they'll be paying attention to. Okay, thank you. And Ms. Wakeham, I think you're next.
Yes, my name is Jeannie Wigum. I'm a volunteer with the Association for Non-Smokers Minnesota. And I would like to put some numbers in context here, if I can. And if the page could pass these out. Today, the tobacco companies all together, linking arms, will spend $750,000 today promoting smoking to our youth. And this year, Minnesota will spend $3.2 million to try and fight them. That's what we're doing. And the department's proposal is to cut 10% out of that. Folks, this is a time finger in an immense dike, and they're suggesting you even pull that finger out. It's a bad idea. Frankly, this work is too important not to do. But there is a long tradition of people turning to the money from tobacco prevention to plug budget holes. Let me give you some ancient history. In 1986, the legislature increased the tobacco tax and devoted one half of a penny to tobacco prevention programs by youth. So that money didn't actually get to people until about 1988 because it was supposed to be tax revenues that were going to come in. In 1991, we had a budget shortfall. By the way, that half cent of tobacco tax came to $1.6 million. That was in 1986. In 1991, the legislature faced a budget shortfall and whacked that program by 30%. The next year, they whacked it by 13%. The next year, they whacked it by 7%. And then by 1993, there was so little money left, they had to really whack it to get anything at all out of it, and they whacked it by 77%, leaving a total of $55,000 for actual program activities to prevent the leading cause of death and disease in this country. Well, you might think that after 1993 we would have figured out that was a really terrible idea, what we just did to prevention programming, but we did it again. At the tobacco settlement, this state brought in $6.2 billion spread out over a period of 25 years. Each year, Philip Morris, R.J. Reynolds, the tobacco company, send this check, this state, a check of about $180 million, ongoing payment, $180 million. In the first couple of years, this legislature used its great wisdom to establish a tobacco endowment that would generate income to provide prevention programming for children of between $17 and $23 million. The next time there was a budget shortfall, whack, the whole thing went away. Not the $17 million, the entire tobacco endowment, money that came out of the tobacco pocket for prevention for our youth, all went to fill the budget shortfall. And today, we're facing another budget shortfall. And the solution? Take a little bit out of the tiny amount we have for preventing youth from starting to smoke. This is youth prevention money. It's a bad idea. It's just a terrible idea. It's too important not to prevent kids from starting to smoke. Thank you.
So next to him list is Stuart Hansen. And are you Sandra? Sandel? Is Sandra Sandel here as well? Oh, you're next. You're after them. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Welcome to the committee.
My name is Stuart Hansen. I'm a pulmonary medicine physician. I practice with South Park Nicot Health Services out in St. Louis Park and Methodist Hospital for over the last 30 years. And I'm here, though, representing the Smoke-Free Coalition, the Minnesota Smoke-Free Coalition. I'm the immediate past president of the coalition. The coalition is an organization of organizations, and representatives that sponsor this are the Heart Association, the American Heart Association, American Lung Association, American Cancer Society, and the major health plans like Blue Cross Blue Shield, Health Partners, and Allina. Minnesota Medical Association started the Smoke-Free Coalition in 1984 and 85, and that was started the first Minnesota tobacco initiatives that Jeannie Weigum was just talking about. And we've seen the investment in prevention go up and down and up and down through the cycles that you all have to deal with. What I do in practice is I treat the end stage of smoking. I treat the asthmatics who are living in a household where somebody else smokes or they smoke themselves, or I treat the people with heart disease or particularly emphysema and lung disease and lung cancer, which is the end stage. So I make my living off of that. But it's very important to go back upstream and to prevent this, and investment in youth initiatives like the Department of Health has been doing is really critical. And you've heard many things about the prevention here, but the Minnesota Department of Health really is the only major player in preventing youth startups of smoking and creating the attitudes of being a non-smoker, a lifelong non-smoker. And they've been very good at it when we had the funds that Jeannie Wigan was talking about, when we had nearly $20 million going into a youth initiative that was showing the decline from like 42% down into the 20% of students coming out of high school who were using tobacco in the last month as they graduated. So we have made tremendous strides, and yet now we're losing ground. And we've reduced the investment in these youth for quite significantly. And another hit like this is, you know, just unconscionable. You say, well, there's lots of money going into tobacco control. Clearway, the Partnership for Action Against Tobacco that was part of the tobacco settlement, and Blue Cross was part of the tobacco settlement with the state. They're investing in adults. They're investing in people who are already smokers and smoking cessation. Prevention is the purview of the Department of Health. And to take away the paltry amount that's already going there would be really, we think, very detrimental to the youth. So I'm speaking here as a physician and trying to defend the health of the youth for the future so that other doctors like me don't have to treat their end-stage disease. So thank you for your opportunity.
Thank you for coming to talk with us today. Would you introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Lisa Marshall. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for having this opportunity. I'm a health educator with Public Health here in St. Paul, Ramsey County, and I am representing the Ramsey Tobacco Coalition. The coalition has existed since 1999, and this is when we did receive some funds so that we could make some major efforts working with youth to reduce the amount of smoking and to provide education in tobacco prevention. Public health has been an integral part of this. We have formed a coalition that has included the major agencies within the county, Lung Heart Cancer Association, and we have included and set up mini grants with the five public school districts. We have agencies that are involved, the Boys and Girls Club. We have the Hallie Q. Brown Center. We have the Vietnamese Americans, the Hmong women. We have all the associations that work with youth. And we've been very fortunate in obtaining grants from MDH, although other people who have worked in youth tobacco prevention has fallen by the wayside, unfortunately. We are working on point of purchase advertising, how advertising influences youth, and we know how many venues there are selling tobacco within our section of the state, and we have a comprehensive list of that. We are now identifying all of those places because we know how the tobacco industry can influence youth. Our advocacy and outreach program includes primarily students and some adults at this point. We have a complete curriculum, which we have just initiated this year, working on advertising and the industry influence. I have all those documents here for you. The curriculum is an after-school type curriculum and includes many interesting activities for students.
I'm wondering if you could wrap up. We're running out of time, and I want to give the last witness a little
bit. I would just like to emphasize that most of us throughout the state have been influenced in some way by the disease that has affected people through tobacco use. And, you know, we strongly encourage you not to cut budget from the tobacco prevention, and I do appreciate the kind words of committee members in those lines. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I think Sandra Sandel?
My name is Sandra Sandel. I'm a retired citizen,
I retired a few years ago after spending about 20 years working on tobacco issues. In those years, I've seen a lot of progress that culminated in the Freedom to Breathe Act. And I've also seen the effect that erratic funding has had on tobacco control programs. And I'd like to make an analogy between tobacco control and a bridge. You'll see what bridge as I continue this analogy. Let's say the bridge is the way we reach our goal of reducing tobacco prevalence to less than 10%. When there is money, we put up a few piers, and we get a little bit of the paving done, but we don't even complete the piers before the funding's cut. And then, because we haven't put the gusset plates on the piers properly, some of the piers start to tumble. When there's funding again, we We rebuild those piers and we do a little more of the paving. I think Ms. Wigum demonstrated how that has been cut, gone up, down, up, down, up, down. And essentially when it's cut, it means that we've wasted a lot of the money we have put in hiring and training people, in developing programs, and organizing in communities. All of this goes by the wayside. We have to start again, building more piers and putting in the gusset plates. So I urge you not to cut the tobacco control budget of the Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, all of you, for your testimony, and I thank members who were able to stay. I know everyone needs to go, so we have just one more little item of business, which is to approve the minutes from the last
procedurally, we are just accepting the report from the department. I mean, we don't vote on it. They're informing.
I think acceptance might be a little too strong word. We're hearing it.
We're hearing. Okay. Yes. I'm sorry. But I just want to say that
this is the governor's bill.
Yeah, they have a very tough job to do.
They do.
They're the messenger, and that reminds me of that old country western song, "Please, General Custer, I don't want to go." And so I think, and we're looking at this thing, they're looking at it from a very high angle and knowing what all the programs are. So it's a tough message, and it's hard for us to hear it, but I want to make sure they don't go out of here too bloody today.
Maybe it's having the chairman. I guess I was responding to the statement that this, you know, the staff basically make the recommendation. I presume we should really be talking about the commissioner. Commissioner makes the recommendation, and so these folks work for the commissioner. The commissioner works for the governor. Governor's supposed to work for the people, and so we're here trying to get the message of the people, I think, back to the governor. And so I appreciate all the, you know, words that I think people have said in support of, you know, the two people who are before us. I guess we're just asking to take back a strong sentiment of concern that's here, anger, frustration, and I think determination maybe to figure out how to help you not have to make those cuts. And I think this is a pretty creative committee. We might be able to come up with some things. But we will probably... Actually, at some point, I really would like the commissioner to come. My request is two things. I'd like to hear back from you next week on the cost-benefit analysis, and I'd like the commissioner to come and talk with us. So we haven't had a chance to do that, and if that would be possible, that would be maybe some information he could deliver. Because I think we can't compel the governor to come. We can't really compel anybody to come, but we can ask. And so we'll ask... I'd like to officially ask the commissioner to come and talk with us about these budgets.
Madam Chair, yes. I'd be happy to work with your staff to find a time that would work for our commissioner. I'd also like to ask that one thing you're not seeing before your committee is a bill that relates to a statewide health improvement plan, $40 million invested in local public health to address obesity issues and alcohol issues and tobacco-related issues. And that's an enormous investment that will help offset some of the reductions that you're seeing in our budget here. And that's something that is not coming before your committee that you haven't seen the whole picture of what the governor is recommending.
If I could ask you a question about that, does it put that money into these same programs for tobacco and, well, wait, there's no obesity cut here, but does it put the money in any way into the tobacco program that we're talking about here?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, it puts money into local communities to address those needs that are most of issue and concern to them. And so for communities in northern Minnesota who feel that alcohol issues are the most important concerns to their communities, they would be able to use the funds in those ways. And for those communities that felt youth tobacco smoking was the most important issue to their community, they would be able to use the funds in those ways.
And how about childhood lead poisoning?
Pardon?
And how about childhood lead poisoning?
Madam Chair, the funds address tobacco use and alcohol use and obesity and drug prevention.
I think maybe it is maybe a bill that we should see. Is this an actual piece of legislation that you're talking about?
Madam Chair, it's Senator Loeffler's bill.
What was being talked about. Yes, I wasn't here for that presentation. So, Senator Loeffler, okay. Does the committee remember this discussion? Okay. I'll have to catch up on that. Representative Moe?
Madam Chair, I don't recall. How does the governor propose to pay for this? Is this a spending increase of $40 million? Where does he propose this?
Representative Moe. I don't recall the funding source in Representative Loeffler's bill.
It's my recollection that it might have been associated with tobacco tax, but I believe there are different funding scenarios in the House and Senate.
And it would be interesting, Representative.
Thank you, Senator. Is the governor? I just want to be clear about this. Is the governor proposing a source of funds for this spending increase, this new program that you're advocating for here?
Madam Chair, Representative Moe, the governor is in support. The governor has not made a proposal yet around health care transformation. The governor is working with House and Senate to come up with a proposal that all three can agree to before he makes a proposal.
Madam Chair, so the governor wants the legislature to come up with a spending proposal and a revenue source that then he can call us tax and send liberals for? I'm sorry. I know this is not from you, but
Madam Chair and Representative
this is what we're hearing in the public from our governor now.
Madam Chair and Representative Moe, as soon as there is I'm sure the governor will put a proposal forward to the legislature when he has reached agreement.
Thank you. The answer is yes. Representative,
I can't speak for the governor.
I know.
I should have that qualifier.
Except that you're all we have is the voice of the governor. So I'm sorry that you're on the front line, but you know we do here expect hopefully you get a chance to weigh in with through your commissioner with the governor. Representative Shumpert.
Madam Speaker or Madam Chair, we heard the $40 million help proposal in Health and Human Services a few days ago, and the initial proposal called for a 25-cent increase in the gas tax, which the governor announced about 2 weeks ago that he would veto. And so we're looking at trying to fund it with the Health Care Access Fund money, but it's going to be real tricky. And everybody supports this major health initiative by the Department of Health. I think it's a plan you've been working on a number of years, I believe. Statewide Health Promotion Plan, I believe it's called.
Madam Chair and Representative Shumpert, we currently have a federal grant. It's called a STEPS grant that we are in, I believe, the second or third year of.
And it's a great community-based approach, but it takes some money, some upfront money, and nobody's quite sure yet whether anybody's going to support funding it. So it's kind of in limbo.
Just real brief. Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to echo Representative Peterson's comments that we don't want to shoot the messengers who bring the message. We do have a responsibility for those of us on this committee to come up with resources to save these programs we all believe are important. So everybody has their own responsibility, I guess, but As I said before, the state has so many times cut preventive programs, which has then led to huge personal deficits for individuals, and then also the state budget. And then politicians come back and say, "Well, you're doing a bad job here," you know. So I'm interested in Representative Moore's comment that maybe we can find some sources here within the legislature to maintain these. So other than just abusing our two messengers here, we also have a responsibility then to try to stand up and come up with some resources too to save these programs that we know, even if the governor is not so sure, are important. Thank you.
All right, we have the two minutes before us, and I'm looking for a motion to approve them, the convention.
So, Madam Chair, I would move minutes for March 11th.
In the morning and in the evening.
In the morning and in the evening, both. Thank you, Madam.
Thank you. That motion is before us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. So, thank you for coming today, and if you could take back that message, we'd like to actually have the commissioner come and talk about, her role in the governor's proposals before us, and also if you could come back with us with some cost-benefit analysis. We're talking about numbers of kids and how much it costs and that sort of thing, and each of the advocates who are here today can maybe give you a head start, but we'd really appreciate that. It would help us, I think, in fighting for the dollars that we really do want to put back on your plate. So, thank you very much. You're adjourned.